Part 2. The Kaiten Menace. October 6th, 1993. Tokyo, Japan. Chapter 18. The final farewell that kamikaze pilots shouted to each other before scrambling to their aircraft was, "See you at Yasukuni." Though they never expected to meet again in the flesh, they did intend to be reunited in spirit at Yasukuni, the revered memorial in honor of those who died fighting for the Emperor's cause since the Revolutionary War of 1868. The compound of the shrine sits on a rise known as Kudan Hill in the middle of Tokyo. Also known as Shokansha, or Spirit-Invoking Shrine, the central ceremonial area was erected under the strict rules of Shinto architecture and is quite bare of furnishings. A cultural religion based on ancient tradition, Shinto has evolved through the years into numerous rites of passage and sects cored around kami, or the way of divine power through various gods. By World War II, it had evolved into a state cult and ethic philosophy far removed from a strict religion. During the American occupation, all government support of Shinto shrines was discontinued, but they were later designated as national treasures and honored cultural sites. The inner sanctuary of all Shinto shrines is off-limits to everyone except for the chief priest. Inside the sanctuary, a sacred object representing the divine spirit's symbol is enshrined. At Yasukuni, the sacred symbol is a mirror. No foreigners are allowed to pass through the huge bronze gateway leading to the war hero's shrine. Curiously overlooked is the fact that the spirits of two foreign captains of ships sunk while supplying Japanese forces during the Russo-Japanese War of 1904, are deified among the nearly 2,500,000 Nipponese war heroes. A number of villains are also enshrined at Yasukuni. Their spirits include early political assassins, underworld military figures, and the war criminals led by General Hideki Tojo, who were responsible for atrocities that matched and often went beyond the savagery of Auschwitz and Dachau. Since the Second World War, Yasukuni had become more than simply a military memorial. It was the rallying symbol of the right-wing conservatives and militants who still dreamt of an empire dominated by the superiority of Japanese culture. The annual visit by Prime Minister Ueda Junichiro and his party leaders to worship on the anniversary of Japan's defeat in 1945 was reported in depth by the nation's press and TV networks. A storm of impassioned protest usually followed from political opposition, leftists and pacifists, non-Shinto religious factions, and nearby countries who had suffered under Japanese wartime occupation. To avoid open criticism and the spotlight of adverse opinion, the ultra-nationalists behind the resurrected drive for empire and the glorification of the Japanese race were forced to clandestinely worship at Yasukuni during the night. They came and went like phantoms, the incredibly wealthy, high government dignitaries, and the sinister manipulators who skirted the shadows, their talons firmly clutching a power structure that was untouchable even by the leaders of government. And the most secretive and powerful of all was Hideki Suma. A light drizzle fell as Suma passed through the gate and walked the gravel path toward the Shokansha Shrine. It was well after midnight, but he could see his way by the lights of Tokyo that reflected from the low clouds. He paused under a large tree and looked around the grounds inside the high walls. The only sign of life was a colony of pigeons nestled under the discs that crowned the curved roof. Satisfied that he would not be studied by an observer, Hideki Suma went through the ritual of washing his hands in a stone basin and rinsing his mouth with a small ladle of water. Then he entered the outer shrine hall and met the chief priest, who was awaiting his arrival. Suma made an offering at the oratory and removed a sheaf of papers wrapped in a tissued scroll from the inside pocket of his raincoat. He gave them to the priest, who laid them on the altar. A small bell was rung to summon Suma's specific deity, or kami, and then they clasped their hands in prayer. After a short purification ceremony, Suma spoke quietly with the priest for a minute, retrieved the scroll, and left the shrine as inconspicuously as he'd arrived. The stress of the past 3 days fell from him like glistening water over a garden fall. Suma felt rejuvenated by the mystical power and guidance of his kami. His sacred quest to purify Japanese culture from the poison of Western influences while protecting the gains of financial empire was guided by divine power. Anyone catching a glimpse of Suma through the misty rain would have quickly ignored him. He looked quite ordinary in workman's overalls and a cheap raincoat. He wore no hat, and his hair was a great shock of brushed back white. The black mane, common to almost all Japanese men and women, had lightened at an early age, which gave Suma a look much older than his 49 years. By Western standards, he was short. By Japanese ideals, he was slightly on the tall side, standing at 170 centimeters. It was only when you looked into his eyes that he seemed different from his native cousins. The irises were of a magnetic indigo blue, the legacy possibly of an early Dutch trader or English sailor. A frail youth, he'd taken up weightlifting when he was 15 and labored with cold determination until he had transformed his body into a muscled sculpture. His greatest satisfaction was not in his strength, but the molding of flesh and sinews into his own creation. His bodyguard chauffeur bowed and locked the heavy bronze gate after him. Moro Kamatori, Suma's oldest friend and his chief aide, and his secretary, Toshie Kudo, were sitting patiently in a backward-facing seat of a black, custom-built Murmoto limousine powered by a 12-cylinder, 600-horsepower engine. Toshie was much taller than her native sisters. Willowy, with long legs, jet-black hair falling to her waist, flawless skin enhanced by magical coffee-brown eyes, she looked as if she'd stepped out of a James Bond movie. But unlike the exotic beauties who hung on fiction's bon vivant master spy, Toshie possessed a high order of intellectual ability. Her IQ bordered on 165, and she operated at full capacity on both sides of the brain. She did not look up as Suma entered the car. Her mind was focused on a compact computer that sat in her shapely lap. Kamatori was speaking over a telephone. His intellect may not have been on a level with Toshie's, but he was meticulous and deviously clever at managing Suma's secretive projects. He was especially gifted at behind-the-scenes finance, pulling the strings and fronting for Suma, who preferred to isolate himself from public view. Kamatori had a stolid, resolute face flanked by oversized ears. Beneath heavy black brows, the dark, lifeless eyes peered through a pair of thick-lensed, rimless glasses. No smile ever crossed his tight lips. He was a man without emotions or convictions. Fanatically loyal to Suma, Kamatori's master talent was hunting human game. If someone, no matter how wealthy or high in government bureaucracy, presented an obstacle to Suma's plans, Kamatori would shrewdly dispatch them so it seemed an accident or the blame could be fixed on an opposing party. Kamatori kept a ledger of his killings with notes detailing each event. Over the course of 25 years, the tally came to 237. He rang off and set the receiver in an armrest cradle and looked at Suma. "Admiral Itakura at our embassy in Washington. His sources have confirmed the White House is aware the explosion was nuclear and originated with the Divine Star." Suma gave a stoic shrug. As the president launched a formal protest with Prime Minister Junshiro, "The American government has remained strangely silent," answered Kamatori. "The Norwegians and British, however, are making noises about the loss of their ships." "But nothing from the Americans?" "Only sketchy reports in their news media." Suma leaned forward and tapped Toshie's nyloned knee with his forefinger. "A photo, please, of the explosion site." Toshie nodded respectfully and programmed the necessary code into the computer. In less than 30 seconds, a colored photo rolled out of a fax machine built into the divider wall separating the driver from the passenger compartment. She passed it to Suma, who turned up the interior car lights and took a magnifying glass from Kamatori. "The enhanced infrared photo was taken an hour and a half ago during a pass by our Akagi spy satellite," explained Toshie. Suma peered through the glass without speaking for a few moments. Then he looked up, questioningly. "A nuclear hunter-killer submarine and an Asian junk? The Americans are not acting as I expected. Odd they didn't send half their Pacific fleet." "Several naval ships are steaming toward the explosion point," said Kamatori, "including a Numa Ocean Survey vessel." "What about space surveillance?" "American intelligence has already gathered extensive data from their Pyramider spy satellites and SR-90 aircraft." Suma tapped a small object in the photo with a finger. "A submersible floating between the two vessels. Where did that come from?" Kamatori peered over Suma's finger at the photograph. "Certainly not the junk. It must have come from the submarine. They won't find any sunken remains of the Divine Star, Suma muttered. She must have been blown into atoms. He tossed the photo back to Toshie. A readout, please, of autocarriers transporting our products, their current status and destinations. Toshie looked up at him over her monitor as if she'd read his mind. I have the data you requested, Mr. Suma. Yes? The Divine Moon finished offloading her autocargo last night in Boston, she reported, reading the Japanese characters on the display screen. The Divine Water, she docked 8 hours ago in the port of Los Angeles and is offloading now. Any others? There are two ships in transport, Toshie continued. The Divine Sky is scheduled to dock in New Orleans within 18 hours, and the Divine Lake is 5 days out of Los Angeles. Perhaps we should signal the ships at sea to divert to ports outside the United States, said Kamatori. American customs agents may be alerted to search for signs of radiation. Who is our undercover agent in Los Angeles? Asked Suma. George Furukawa directs your secret affairs in the southwestern states. Suma leaned back, obviously relieved. Furukawa is a good man. He will be alert to any hardening of American customs procedure. He turned to Kamatori, who was speaking into the phone. Divert the Divine Sky to Jamaica until we have more data, but allow the Divine Lake to proceed to Los Angeles. Kamatori bowed in acknowledgement and reached for his phone. Aren't you running the danger of detection? Asked Toshie. Suma tightened his lips and shook his head. American intelligence agents will search the ships, but they'll never discover the bombs. Our technology will defeat them. The explosion on board the Divine Star came at a bad time, said Toshie. I wonder if we'll ever know what caused it. I am not interested, nor do I care, Suma said coldly. The accident was unfortunate, but it won't delay completion of our Kaiten project. Suma paused, his face etched in a brutal expression. Enough pieces are set in place to destroy any nation which threatens our new empire.